Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards. Save big money
at Menards. It's another busy year ahead for Time Team.
From the Roman fort of Branadunum to a mystery at the Ness of Brodgar,
we're getting to know the sites you'll explore with us in 2026.
Hello then, and welcome to the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Helen Geek.
Yes, this is the podcast that brings archaeology to life, and we're having a bit of a look ahead this week, aren't we, Martin?
Well, we are, because 2026 is going to be a big one for Time Team. We're on site at locations up and down the country. So we're using the podcast today to learn a little more about just two of them. Before we do that, though, Helen, can I just get your thoughts on a remarkable find that's got a lot of archaeologists really excited? It's been kind of in the news and everything. It's the discovery in Norfolk of a complete battle trumpet, or a carnyx, as it's also known. Everyone's been talking about it over the last few days, and I just thought this is right up your street, surely.
Oh, yes, it is absolutely right up my street. And in fact, I was lucky enough to see it in the conservation lab.
Oh, wow.
Being unpicked out of the block it was lifted in. I mean, it took weeks and weeks, and it was really, really hard work because the block was so enormous. It's actually parts of at least two carnices, as the plural goes, because there are two mouthpieces. So that means there must have been at least parts of at least two. But the point about it is that there's enough there to reconstruct, as you say, a complete example. And that's the first one that has been found in the UK. And it is absolutely enormous.
So what would they have been used for then?
Well, that's a really good question. And we have pictures, believe it or not, of carnices being used on the Gundestrup cauldron, which is a late Iron Age decorated silver cauldron with these really detailed, really good pictures. And there's a row of what appear to be soldiers blowing a carnyx each. Because they're used by warriors, we think of them as a kind of war trumpet, a kind of fighting equipment thing. I suppose there are still military bugles, aren't there?
Yeah, I was going to say, to sort of give instructions on the battlefield.
Yes, and other people have said, or to frighten the enemy. And in fact, the new find does, to a certain extent, confirm the information from the Gundestrup cauldron, because the other items in the hoard were also war gear. There were five shield bosses, small domed things to protect your hand, made again of a copper alloy. And there was also a boar standard, which is a kind of rallying point, perhaps, for your army. And that seems to have been made in the same style as that main bit of carnyx, the big trumpety end known as the bell. So they seem to be a kind of matching set. And the whole thing has got a very warlike feel to it.
I'm just trying to picture what this would have sounded like. And if they're big, does that mean it would have been quite a low sound, a low brass sound?
Mm. You mean it's big like a tuba or a euphonium or something, and they're low, aren't they?
That's my thinking.
Yes. Now, I know that in the past you have played the trumpet, so you're one
well,
up on me.
Well, not very well.
but at least you've done it. And these mouthpieces, they're pretty much identical to the modern trumpet mouthpiece. So it must have been played in the same way, using a kind of vibration of the lips. There has been a replica made of the only other surviving bit of carnyx that's been found in Britain. That was a fragment that was found in a bog at Deskford in Scotland about 200 years ago. That replica, I've heard it played by different people. And you can make a huge range of sounds. You can make a really kind of eerie, harsh sound. You can also play low notes and even high notes. And I do wonder whether maybe you can't make very low notes on a small brass instrument, but maybe you can make high notes on a large one, if you see what I mean. And so if the closest modern equivalent is a hunting horn or a military bugle, or even maybe something like an alp horn, I mean, it's not as big as an alp horn, but it's getting that way, it could have been used to make a range of sounds, both to signal, to give call signs, but also to frighten the other side. Now, the Deskford Carnix, when that was found, that apparently had a wooden tongue, and it's described as having been held on with springs that then, of course, in the way of ancient archaeology, crumbled into dust. So there may have been an element of a percussion sound in there too, with the wooden tongue slapping against some other part of the Carnix.
Ooh, it's amazing.
Time Team had a go at a similar thing to this. Years and years ago, it was one of my first ones. We had this brilliant experiments producer, Ros Herrera. Ros rather brilliantly did this reconstruction of something called a Draco, and she needed somebody to design the noise-making device because it's not blown by human lungs, a Draco. It seems to have been blown by the wind.
Oh.
And in the end, we used a set of Chinese kite whistles. And what Ros did was to get a bloke on a horse to ride very, very fast with this thing into the wind, and the wind blew the sound. The wind acted as the blast for the whistle. I wasn't allowed to ride the horse, but I did get to try it on a bicycle. And it was
not quite as romantic, though, is it?
No, but it was. I was a passenger on a side-by-side tandem, so I didn't have to both hold the handlebars and hold the Draco. But again, that was a very eerie and extraordinary sound. The Draco is Roman. The Carnix seems to be late Iron Age. But of course, the late Iron Age is very influenced by the Roman presence. The second you say late Iron Age in Norfolk, because this Carnix is a Norfolk find, everybody's eyes immediately turn to Boudica. Mm. She's famous for her prowess in war. She's exactly the right date. She had prestige objects from the descriptions of her. Could it be connected with Boudica? I mean, it's a very tempting thought.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot more work to be done before we'll know the answers. Now, we're getting very excited about our visit to a Neolithic site called the Ness of Brodka, which is on Orkney, a group of islands off the north coast of Scotland. And that's happening over a month during the summer. And there's been a huge amount of speculation about what we might find there ever since we told you about it a few weeks ago.
Yeah, and speculation for good reason, actually. John Gator, Time Team's geophysicist, hinted at something remarkable under the soil, which we are hoping that we're going to be able to excavate. Now, I thought it might help, though, to explain a little more about what the Ness of Brodka actually is, why it's such an important site, all of that kind of stuff. Nick Card, the director of the Ness of Brodka, who was with John when we were talking about it a few weeks ago, is back with us now. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Martin. Hi, Helen. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you, Nick. It's lovely to see you. Now, can I ask you, what's the reaction been like since you and John revealed the news about doing more archaeology at the Ness of Brodka?
Well, the Ness has always attracted a huge amount of attention, but I think the anticipation about what this unknown feature is has really caught the imagination of everybody. You know, the number of newspapers, television companies, radio, etc. There's really just been a bit maybe exaggerated, but hopefully the result will prove to be something exceptional.
A proper mystery, and I think everybody loves that idea, not knowing what it is and then revealing it. It's very, very exciting. Let's just take it back to the very, very beginning, the very basics here, Nick. What is the Ness of Brodka?
Well, Ness of Brodka came as a complete surprise, I think, to all of us, over 20 years of excavation. But what we've uncovered is this massive complex of Neolithic buildings, the like of which really haven't been seen before, such a concentration. It's not just a single phase of site. We have structures being built on top of structures and top of structures. There's many different phases to the site. And it really spans the whole of the Neolithic of northern Britain from about 3,500 to about 2,400 BC.
The project has been going on for a couple of decades now, hasn't it? And you had originally planned to end it. You'd got to the end of a solid, well-thought-out project. What's changed?
Well, I think that although the main trenches have all been backfilled, all these amazing three-dimensional Neolithic structures are now covered, hidden from view. because we felt that we had reached a stage where we could build up a complete narrative for the site. But you could have excavated there for the next 200 years and still not excavated at all. But we always said that if there were specific research questions that were thrown up during the post-excavation, then we would consider doing some kind of keyhole surgery. And that's exactly what we're going to be doing in the summer. What the geophysics, particularly the ground-penetrating radar, showed up last year was something unusual, at least in the context of the Ness. So I think this does need to be investigated because we think it could add another chapter to the history of this amazing site.
Going back to the site itself, why is the Ness of Brodgar important? Why is it a site that needs the recognition that luckily it is now starting to get, with more and more people learning about it, learning about its importance within that landscape and that area?
Well, I think over the last 20 years of excavation, the Ness has already created a kind of aura to it, because what we've uncovered is really unlike anything else known, really in northwestern Atlantic Europe. But it's got this potential to add in a kind of extra dimension to these amazing sites, which it sits in amongst the great iconic monuments, the Ring of Brodgar, Stones of Stenness, all the sites that constitute the heart of Neolithic Orkney World Heritage Site. So it's helping to unravel some of the mysteries surrounding them. But it also has the potential to illuminate many, many other aspects of Neolithic life 5,000 years ago, looking at the development of Neolithic society. So there's many, many different aspects of what we've uncovered at the Ness, which will have much wider ramifications than just Orkney.
So what is it about Orkney that is so extraordinary? Why does prehistoric Orkney seem to be the cauldron of so many things starting? You know, the earliest grooved ware pottery, it's got some of the most extraordinary megalithic monuments. It's got the Ness of Brodgar. It's got so much. Whereas now we tend to think of it as being a bit peripheral, a bit chilly, a bit windy, on the edge of Britain. And yet it seems to have, thousands of years ago, been at the absolute centre.
You shouldn't say that in front of any Orkadians, because the Orkney still is the centre of the universe. When you live in Orkney, you appreciate the richness of it, the very rich soil. Farming is still the most important part of the Orkadian economy, but it's also the local stone. One of the reasons why we get all these amazing monuments surviving is the local stone. It's like naturally occurring Lego blocks. It can be constructed into these wonderful monuments. So it's there just waiting to be prized from the ground and put together into these amazing sites like the Ness of Brodgar, like Scarrow Brae, etc. It is the fertility of the soil. I think it's always said, even today, that an Orkadian is a farmer with a fishing boat, whereas a Shetlander is a fisherman with a small croft. Totally different emphasis on the economy. And I think that goes right the way back into prehistory, when we see, for instance, the importance of cattle, which in the Neolithic period, it was there, it was part of the kind of social status of the Orkadians. And it still in some ways is. But I've got a certain magic to it as well. I always think the skies here are just huge. When you see the winter skies illuminated by the northern lights, not just a kind of shimmering a curtain on the northern horizon, but sometimes filling the whole sky. It's a magical place.
Oh, I cannot wait to see it. I really can't. Just going back to the archaeology that you'd already done, this huge project over many, many, many years, what were some of the standout discoveries that you made in the work that you've already done?
There's so many. People often ask me what's my favourite discovery at the Ness. Well, I think it's the Ness as a whole. It's every aspect of it. But if I had to kind of pick out one or two, well, there's the buildings, these wonderful pieces of Neolithic architecture, really statements in stone, the like of which we haven't seen before. Some of the walls decorated with incised pect art, but also colour. And the roofs as well, these stone slated roofs. But then we have some of the artefacts. Not that archaeologists, not that we're treasure hunters by any manner of means, but it still doesn't fail to excite when you discover a beautiful polished stone mace head or axe. Or we're very lucky enough to find a Neolithic carved stone ball in context. So many different things.
Wow. Well, we absolutely cannot wait to head up to see you and the site. And it just sounds extraordinary. And I'm afraid to say that after characterising Orkney as windy and chilly, I have still never been there. And it's one of my great bucket list things to go up to Orkney and find out what it's all about. So thank you so much, Nick, for coming on the podcast. It's been absolutely fantastic to hear a bit more from you.
Now, if you haven't seen it already, Time Team got a really, really lovely write-up in The Guardian a couple of weeks ago. Loads of positive stuff about our comeback, all funded, of course, and supported by the wonderful Time Team members. I don't know, did you get a chance to see the article? It was lovely. It was a really nice article.
It was a really great article, and it seems to have been very well read. It was number 8 on the top 10 Guardian stories for a while. When I saw it, yeah, I was so pleased. And the article was excellent because it emphasised what we can do differently now that we've got the freedom to go after what we think is interesting, and we can tailor what we do and what we show to the needs of that particular site or that particular story.
Yeah, and it talked a little bit about the things that we are looking forward to as well doing in the future, and there is so much to look forward to. And very shortly we're going to tell you a little bit more about another site that we hope to be visiting this year with a guest that you know very well, Helen. If you can shout him over or something, he might bring you a cup of tea, maybe.
He's coming from the kitchen, so let's hope. First, though, with it being January, the team that's on both the archaeology side and the production crew side is back from their break, and they're already hard at work preparing for some of the exciting things coming your way.
Hello, Bear here. I do computer graphics and 3D reconstructions. It's very much graphic production time at the moment, with various program edits underway. I've got to complete the exciting graphics for a King's Lynn Guildhall Theatre special, which I'm loving.
Hi, this is Emily Bolting, senior producer. We're getting stuck into the preparations for our digs, which are coming up starting in March. We've been in edit suites, and I'm currently doing week 2 of Sutton Hoo season 2. Lots of good things hopefully coming your way very soon.
My name's John Beaver, and I'm Time Team's mechanical digger driver. We have a new Time Team dig coming up very shortly. It's trying to figure out what size machine we're going to need. We need a big one, 13 ton, 20 ton, or even just a small 3 or 5 ton.
Hi, this is Carenza. I'm one of the Time Team archaeologists. I have to finish off the report into the Time Team test pit digging at Norton Disney. I think most exciting is that I've got a great project which is going to be doing a test pit digging in 3 villages, up to 90 test pits, hundreds of members of the local community. So I'll hope to be able to update you about that later in the year.
I'm Keith Westcott, Time Team's detecting team manager. I'm going to be researching past practice and feeding that back into what we call the Spears approach.
Ivan here, Time Team volunteer digger. I'll need to start thinking about bunting out all my digging kit from the shed, cleaning it and making sure I've got everything I'll need. Lots of planning to do.
This is Carol, production manager on Time Team. Well, I'm doing quite a bit on logistics for Brian Caster. I'm doing paperwork, budgets, housekeeping, lots of practical things like that.
My name's George and I'm a producer-director. I'm currently holed up in the edit, finishing off our return to Cherrington. We had a very wet and wild weekend digging back on the site, and we followed whatever we did find through conservation. So, just dropping in the graphics and tightening the show, and that should be ready for you very soon.
There you go then, just a little snapshot of what's going on behind the scenes in the depths of winter.
Yeah, now I've still got a lot to do on the Broomswell bucket. I've got a lot of experts to contact and to ask questions about, because it's this time of the winter that we've got time to have those longer chats that often we don't manage to do when we're in the thick of getting stuff done in the field.
Everybody is still busy, you see, even though we're not actually there with trowels in our hands or whatever. We're still busy at it. Shall we talk then about another really exciting dig that we hope will be happening in 2026? Now, you might remember the geophysics that we did a few months ago at the site of the Roman fort of Brannadunum in Brancaster in Norfolk. In fact, we were there on site as it was happening, and you can hear that podcast again now. It's there for you to listen to. Soon, you'll be able to watch the Time Team film that we made whilst we were there. But what we can tell you already is that there was enough kind of wow moments to get the geophysics team very, very excited indeed.
Yes, now it's looking like we're going to have to get our hands dirty to investigate some of what showed up in the data. But what might we have in store?
Well, we've looked far and wide for an expert on that site. And well, as luck would have it, there's one right under our nose, because Angus Wainwright, Helen's husband, is the National Trust archaeologist for the East of England. So basically knows Brannadunum like the back of his hand. And he's there with you, is he then, Helen?
He is. I've managed to inveigle him into my study and he is sharing my microphone. Angus, welcome to the Time Team podcast.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to it.
Let's set Brannadunum in a bit of context, shall we, Angus? What do we need to know? What do people need to know about Brannadunum? What are the kind of headline facts here?
Well, Brannadunum is a Roman fort, and we know about its name actually from an early 5th century document which describes all the forts and the officers, military officers right across the empire. The site itself has been investigated in a small way over many years, going right back into the 19th century, but really just with tiny little trenches. So what Time Team has done, especially with the geophysics, is absolutely revolutionise our understanding of this fort. And in fact, it's now, I would say, the best understood of these Saxon shore forts, which sort of stretch around the East Anglian coast and round the south of England as well.
One of the things that Time Team has done to help is also, of course, it was the last Channel 4 Time Team, the last three-day Channel 4 Time Team ever filmed. And so that is available to watch if you want to bone up on Brannadunum and what we knew back in 2012. But Angus, when you say it's the best understood, I mean, we spend our entire time bickering with each other, I'm afraid, because I'm going to say maybe it's not already the best understood. It's the best documented, in a sense. When you look at the geophysics, it looks like the whole thing's been excavated. It looks like someone's been out and drawn a plan. But we don't know what any of those buildings are, do we?
Yeah, well, I suppose I have to admit you're right, Helen. what should we say about the geophysics? The geophysics is absolutely brilliant. John and Jimmy say that the magnetometry and the ground penetrating radar that they did at Brannadunum and of the surrounding sort of civil settlement around the fort was the best they've done themselves and the best they've seen. So Helen's right. When you look at the ground penetrating radar sort of plots of the fort, you can see all the buildings laid out before you, and it looks like a brilliant excavation plan. So you might say, well, why do we need to dig any holes at all? The trouble is that although you can see the plans of the buildings, we don't know what date they are. The fort itself might have lasted for 200 years, so it will have changed its purpose. And so that would have been reflected in the changes to buildings inside, one building put on top of another. And that's what we really need to tease out. Can we detect changes in the function of the fort? Can we see different phases of construction? And that we can only really do that through excavation, I think.
What I don't understand about it at all yet is, despite the fact that I work in Norfolk and I ought to know a reasonable amount about the county, the Roman Norfolk and Roman East Anglia as a whole, they're not particularly well understood, are they? I mean, Brancaster is this site that's right in the north on the coast, but there's only one other town between that and Colchester, which is the civitas capital, as it's known, of Venter Iconorum or Caistor Norwich. That's quite an unusual place that's had a lot of excavation there as well. I mean, do we have any idea how Brancaster relates to Caistor by Norwich or Caistor St Edmund, it's also known as? It's got so many names. Do we know how they related to each other, or is that one of the things that we ought to be thinking about as well?
Stuart came along to the Time Team project, which we've just done, the geophysics. He had a lot of interesting thoughts, as usual for Stuart, and he was particularly looking at the Roman roads which cross Norfolk, well, not exactly aimed at Brannadunham, but aiming for the coast. Does this help us understand how the fort was functioning? One of the theories about the forts is that they were actually to do with the control of trade. So they maybe were operating sort of a taxation system, but a protection system for traders who would have come to the coast and then traded under the protection of the army. And then, of course, the trade goods would spread out across Norfolk along these Roman roads. What Stuart has done is put the fort in its sort of landscape context and given us some extra thoughts about how the fort might have operated in combination with the Roman navy or with trading vessels coming into the fort, or maybe not actually coming to the fort, but coming to a hive or a little port a little distance away from where the fort is.
So we know that the Romans were there. We've got a sort of vague idea of what they were doing, but it seems that there are quite a lot of questions to be answered on why exactly they were there and how that fort fits in with the other things that the Romans were doing in the local area. What other questions are you hoping that a dig on that site might be able to answer?
I think we have to be a little bit cautious because we're only going to be digging for 3 days and there's limits to what you can do in 3 days. So we really need to think about the questions we need answering very carefully and make sure they're questions that can be answered with quite small trenches dug over the 3 day period. If we do the dig, we're going to target some of the buildings we can see within the fort, one of which clearly has different phases of use, so we can explore those to see whether the building changes its function and at what date those changes happen. We still actually don't have an absolute date for the construction of the fort or some obvious alterations to it. So another trench we might aim to look at those questions. And then there's this huge settlement round the fort. We did a lot of geophysics on that, but we never actually found the edge of it. It just spreads out in all directions. So we might look at that as well to see if we can understand how that developed around the fort and what people were doing in this settlement.
Am I right in thinking that it's the largest Roman settlement in Norfolk at the moment because you haven't found the edges?
Yeah, it could be. I've looked at a few others and it does seem to be heading in that direction. And as Helen just said, we don't actually have the edges of the settlement. So that makes it a significant Roman site in Norfolk, even if it didn't have a fort in it at all.
Yes, and from my point of view, I would also, of course, love to know not just when it starts, but when it ends, what happens afterwards, because Brancaster doesn't go as late as you might think. So I won't ask you to answer that one now, because that would be just speculation, wouldn't it?
Well, yes, you always like to drag things through to the Anglo-Saxon period, don't you? And I think that's what you're saying. Well, are we going to find some Anglo-Saxons at Brannadunham? Which, actually, funnily enough, wouldn't be surprising because many of the other Saxon shore forts actually do have Anglo-Saxon settlements.
That's true.
Inside them.
Well, and I hope I will be allowed to do something to do with that. But until then, it's been very kind of you, Angus, to come through from the kitchen into the study and join the podcast. But I'm now going to take the headphones off you and carry on chatting to Martin.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for coming all this way.
I'll get back to my workstation, get back in my car and drive all the way to the kitchen to get back to my computer.
Lovely.
Bye.
Bye.
Questions time now on the Time Team podcast, and Time Team members have been joining the community chat section over on Patreon, which is where you can go to submit your question that Helen can answer. We've got two of them to end the podcast for you now, and the first comes from Mike. He says, a question I've often pondered and would love to hear Helen's expertise on is how unusual is the archaeological heritage of the UK? It feels like the variety of our landscape and the complexity of our history has left a uniquely deep and widespread record. But, says Mike, I realise this is probably just patriotic bias and the picture in our near European neighbours must be very similar. Or is it? wonders, Mike. I know exactly what you mean, I have to say here, Mike, because in my head it's just, oh yes, we've got the best archaeology, but I'm basing that on nothing, really.
This is an interesting question, isn't it? What constitutes the best archaeology? Because something that strikes me quite often is kind of the reverse, that we've got relatively little in terms of the weight of finds in the UK. Because what strikes me is that for much of our history, perhaps maybe up to the medieval period, we seem to have less pottery, for example, than the Roman Empire or the Mediterranean coast or wherever. I've noticed this because we tend to measure our pottery in terms of boxes. We do field walking and we feel pleased if we find one sherd per 20 paces or something. If you work in the south of France, you have literally tons of pottery. It's just so ubiquitous. This is the kind of question, why are some places much richer than others? It's the kind of question that was asked in the book Guns, Germs and Steel by Jared Diamond. That was a really groundbreaking book. Why are some parts of the world richer than others? And in that book, at root, he said, it's really to do with the physical environment. If you've got fertile soil, if you've got domesticated animals, you've got lots of abundant food. If you are living somewhere nice and cosy, and I'm particularly thinking about the weather at the moment in Britain, which is absolutely freezing, if you don't have to worry too much about putting on clothes, making clothes, spinning, weaving, etc., you don't have to keep lighting your fire, and you've got lots of food, you can generate a surplus pretty easily. And then you can use that surplus so that somebody in your community has got time to make things because they can be fed out of everybody else's surplus. Eventually that builds up to mean that you can afford towns and theatres and orchestras and books and culture and churches and wars and jewellery and fast cars and jet-powered aeroplanes and going to the moon eventually. All those things. Whatever floats your boat, you can have it as part of your surplus. So that's the theory. But of course, it's much more complicated than that. It doesn't just come out of your physical environment. It also comes out of things like, well, if you can enslave people, then they can work to create your surplus. If you can get more power to your industry by using fossil fuels, for example, then again, you become much richer. And in the UK, we did both of those two things very enthusiastically and maybe a little bit earlier than some other countries. That covers kind of how rich we are. I think we are richer now and we weren't necessarily quite so rich in the more distant past. But then Mike talks about how complex our history is. And you were saying this too, Martin. So that really is a reflection of how much change has happened here. And like you two, I also tend to think that we are a pretty complex bunch of people. Do you think that that might be something to do with being an island? Because for most of our history, it's been quicker to travel by water than over land. And so being an island, does that mean that instead of being cut off, as we might think about it now, we actually are better connected? We've got more influences. We've got more migrants reaching us. So we've got more ideas.
Yeah. And I guess as well, because we are an island, we are confined in terms of space, in that all the stuff that's got to go on has got to happen within a very confined area. And therefore, it's more likely to happen all one on top of the other. Whereas I guess if you're in the middle of the European mainland, you can spread out, you can have different groups going to different bits of it and not necessarily interacting as much.
That's another good idea, that migrants in terms of people or in terms of ideas can't just go off somewhere and do their own thing. Everybody's got to react. Everybody's got to live together. Yeah, maybe it is. I do often wonder whether this is why Britain has so much in common with Japan. They're both relatively small islands off relatively big land masses with big, powerful neighbours nearby. I've often been sceptical of environmental determinism, meaning that these things just happen because of the way that the world works. But the more you look at it, the more you think, well, we're unavoidably influenced by the world around us.
And what I think we've concluded here is that, yeah, we've got the best archaeology. Yeah, okay, chopped up.
You might be right. You might be right.
Or maybe not. Who knows? It's still a question that needs to be answered, I think, and we'll never get there. Let's have the final question, and it comes from Catherine Turner, who says, I've noticed in the classic episodes, so some of our older Time Team episodes from back when we were on the TV, that hardly anyone wears work gloves while digging. This is the health and safety police here. Even while doing coursework like shifting rubble. Also, it seems like many people wear a surprising amount of jewellery that must get very dirty. Why do they do this? Has this changed over time? So this is what equipment archaeologists need to do their jobs. Gloves, things getting dirty, hazards of the occupation, really, I guess.
Gosh, that's... Catherine, you have spoken out loud something that doesn't often get asked. We all wonder it, I think, and none of us want to say what the real answers are. So, deep breath. The first one is that it's us being macho. People avoid using kneeling pads. They say, no, I don't need gloves because we want to be seen as tough. It isn't easy to dig in gloves if you're not used to them. But then it also isn't easy to dig if you keep on having to stick plasters on the flint injuries and the burst blisters and you've got dirty hands. My experience means that I absolutely know about how to stick a plaster on and continue to work because I do come from that no gloves generation. My tip, incidentally, if you're interested, is wash your hands, let them dry very thoroughly, but stick on your plaster at the beginning of tea break because a plaster's adhesive takes some time to set. So if you stick it on at the beginning of lunch or tea break, you can have it on all day. If you stick it on at the end of tea break, it will not last until the next tea break. That is my tip for people who insist on digging without gloves. And you will need plasters. Absolutely, it is bad for your hands. Now, you might notice in the Sutton Hoo programmes that Justin made us all try to wear gloves. He said, just try them. New gloves are better than old gloves. He didn't want us to end up with plasters all over ourselves. These gloves that he issued us with, they're thin, but they're strong. So most of us have now been persuaded that digging in gloves is a good idea. I now have to move on to the jewellery question, which is another really embarrassing thing, because this is vanity. Time team people know that they might be on television, even if they're just digging in a corner by themselves. And so we like to look nice. And so we do tend to wear jewellery, which we might not wear on other sites. We also tend to wear maybe nail varnish and a bit of makeup.
Because you know you're going to be on TV.
I know, everybody wants to look nice. I did, though, once ask Bridge, because I've managed to find a way of asking her in a way that I thought wasn't rude. I said, Bridge, you're going to get your nail varnish chipped. Why do you wear nail varnish? And she said, it's because I'm a conservator. She trained as an archaeologist and then as an archaeological conservator. And archaeological conservators aren't allowed really to wear nail varnish because it dissolves in acetone. They use acetone a lot. You cannot risk losing some of your nail varnish onto an object. Mm. And so she said, all of the day job, I can't wear it. On time team, nobody tells me not to, so I do. And I think that it's not until you hear those personal stories of why people wear what they wear that you understand. Because I have a ring that I've always worn on site, but it's because I wear it all the time. It was my grandmother's ring. And when my mother gave it to me when I was 16, she said, you must never take this off. If you take it off, you will lose it. Never take it off. So I don't take it off. And Angus and my wedding rings, we got specially made slightly thinner. I mean, admittedly, it did have the byproduct of making them slightly cheaper because they use slightly less gold. Mm-hmm. But they're slightly thinner front to back so that they give us less blisters so we can carry on wearing them while we dig. And a lot of people have got a story like that. It's something special to them.
Yeah. It makes sense, even if it isn't the right thing to do, in inverted commas, for sort of making sure you don't get blisters and bad things happening to your hands and that sort of thing. But that is where you are very honest there, and I appreciate that, and I'm sure Catherine appreciates that as well. If you have a question that you'd like to ask Helen, and maybe she can reveal some deep, dark secrets she never thought that she would ever utter, then you need to be a Time Team member, and you can just go to patreon.com/timeteamofficial. If you go there, you can sign up, and there's a chat section, and that is where you ask your question. Very easy to do.
Yes, and in fact, next week, I'm going to be answering more questions because it's one of those podcast episodes that's dedicated to your questions from Time Team members. And there will be another edition of Helen's Find, where I introduce you to an ancient object with a story to tell, which I haven't picked yet, but I will have to go and have a burrow through things and see what I can find to entertain you.
If you could, please. Thank you. And thank you for listening. We will speak to you next week, very soon indeed, on the next edition of the Time Team podcast.
Bye-bye.